My name is Laura Stark. I'm professor of ethnology here in this department, history and ethnology. And
I'm Bert Diachman, and I'm one of the professors of history here in this department.
And basically, we're going to do several things today. We are going to I'm going to briefly go through this course schedule so that you know when you need to show up here. And we also have this videoed for those of you who may not be able to make it every time. Okay, and it will be on Moni PhD.
Thank you. And basically, we have different, we also have Professor Yari Oyala, who will be giving two lectures. So basically, this course is the same as what you see in Korpi or Moodle, and the only thing that has changed is the place on Wednesday, the 10th of October. So just note the place, it's in Ruusupuisto. And then basically what we're going to do next is we're going to quickly show, I think we can go to the, oh yes. We are also going to pass around a name list. We are not, after this, going to be taking your attendance, but we would be very interested in knowing which disciplines you come from. So please just write your name and your discipline so that we have an idea of what kind of group we have here, since this is a faculty-wide course. Okay, so we're going to talk briefly, first of all, about sort of where we're coming from today in our idea about the course. So these are important points to keep in mind when submitting research for publication. But we're just going to talk briefly about that because we also want today to be more of a discussion. And after we briefly talk about these points, and if you have specific questions about these points, we will ask that. We also want to hear about your own experience in publishing so far, and we want to hear about your own hopes for this course. So what are you looking to get out of this course that we can make sure that we try to cover it in the next lectures? Okay, so I think I'll give this to now to Pertti, our important points that we felt you should keep in mind when publishing, especially internationally.
Okay, this feels like a kind of duet performance, passing the microphone back and forth. But yes, we jointly kind of thought of a few items that or issues that we thought were important when thinking about publishing journal articles and trying to publish journal articles. And we've written down a number of them, and we'll read them now kind of in turn. So first of all, you need to decide which journal you will submit the article to or what the kind of target journal will be for that particular article, because the journals, as you probably know, have very different expectations about that. The word limits vary quite widely. Some journals, not very many, but some allow very long articles. Many don't, and they often enforce the word limits quite strictly. And there's also varying expectations about style in terms of the sort of format that the article has to have and whether to use, if you publish in English, British or American spelling and other linguistic conventions, that kind of thing. So that's certainly one key thing that I think you need to, at the very beginning of the process of writing and submitting a particular article, to bear in mind. So, Laura?
Okay. Thank you, Pertti. Okay, so Pertti already mentioned the word count limit. And I know that it varies by discipline, but I can just say that in my discipline, it varies usually between 7,000 and 10,000 words. And 7,000 is quite a short article. So you need to keep in mind then when you're thinking about an article to write, you want to say something small. You're not going to be solving all the world's problems in one article. That's just not possible. So you'll need to keep it short. And then it's really a good idea to read already published articles in the journal that you're interested in. Look at their format. Look at how they open the article. Look at how they argue their main points. Okay, and this is important because that's going to be the style. if the editors of that journal have already said yes to that article and it's been published, then that's a style you can work with. And there will be probably varying a range of styles, but you need to be familiar with what they're looking at. Do they like qualitative data or quantitative data? That's very important. That's a big dividing line between a lot of journals, and to look at what other people have done so far in that journal. Okay.
Right. Yes. Sorry. Just making sure that I'm not going to repeat what was just said. So another important thing has to do with the sort of, let's say, ranking or scholarly value and so on of journals. Now, this is somewhat complicated. There's different rankings. There's different systems of sort of prioritizing what the most important journals are. And these also vary somewhat between different national settings. In the Finnish context, for instance, we've now had for about 6 years the UFO, J-U-F-O system, which is a system for kind of categorizing and classifying journals, also book publishers, on a four-level scale, starting from three, which is the very highest global standard, to zero, which is sort of acceptable standard still, but not perhaps very internationally prominent. Other countries use different criteria sometimes, and they don't always exactly match. But many of the kind of top journals or publishers certainly do across the board. So you need to think about this a little bit before you send something in to a particular journal. These kinds of issues are becoming increasingly important. The sort of ratings given to particular journals and publishers in the scientific community does play an increasingly big role, and it can be very important for an individual researcher or pretty much any researcher, really. So there's different kinds of rankings, as I said, but it's a good idea to sort of think about this and familiarize yourself a little bit with the reputation and sort of scholarly ranking of that journal. However, there's also complicating factors in this. Ideally, of course, everybody would want to publish in the number one globally leading journal, or one of the very leading journals. However, obviously, and I don't really need to even say this, but the kind of higher you go on the scale, the more selective the journals are. And it often can also take a considerably long time to get something published in one of those very top journals, even if it does get accepted. They often have long sort of queues of publications waiting to come out. So you need to kind of weigh these factors. It's a good idea to talk to your supervisors, to more senior people in the field who have maybe more of a feel of what the kind of lay of the land would be, what kind of journal your particular article would be most suitable to. So I'm sorry if I've made that sound a little bit complex. I'm afraid it is a little bit complex, but it's important to think about this, where the journal that you are considering sits in this kind of wider landscape of scholarship.
And I would add to that that it's very important nowadays that it's online, that it's available online. This is even important if you are writing in Finnish for Finnish readers, because people just can access it much more easily and more quickly. But especially if you're writing in English or another international language, so to speak, you have a worldwide readership then if you can publish online. So it's very important to make sure it's an online journal. Okay, so next slide. Yep, and now for all types of publications, I would say that really most important is to realize that publishing your research is a very long, very frustrating process usually. Be ready for that frustration. Understand that everybody has to go through this, and that you need to be diplomatic with the editors. You you will never be communicating with the reviewers directly. You do that through the editors, but you know, we'll go through about more about what you need to do. But you will succeed if you don't panic and you don't give up, okay? And you will succeed if you don't take it personally. So don't, this is, when you submit an article for publication and you get criticism back, don't take it personally. This is not about you. It's not about how good of a researcher you are. It's about your text. We are all blind to the texts that we write. We make, there are parts that are unclear to a reader always. I still do it, and I've been doing it for 25 years. It's just practice, practice, practice. So be happy for the feedback and criticism you get from the reviewers. Usually they are genuinely trying to help. So just tell yourself, this is going to take a couple of years, because a couple of years is a normal time from when you submit until when it finally comes out. You know, there might be several rounds of review. There's going to be a lot of frustration. But if you know that going in, then it's easier to handle. Okay,
let's see. So we're still in the reviewing process, really. That's right what Laura was saying about patience being needed and also a kind of somewhat of a thick skin, because it can sort of hurt when people criticize something that you've been putting so much energy into. But you're right that you should try not to take it personally, at least. But really also it's important to bear in mind in that context that the reviewers, really, as Laura has said here on the slide behind me, they almost never recommend that the first version of the article be accepted as such. That does happen, but it's very rare. Usually, as a reviewer, I've done quite a lot of reviewing for different journals, and you normally have, as a reviewer, four options. You can say reject, that this is just not good enough for this particular journal for whatever reason. Maybe the quality isn't quite good, or maybe it's just the wrong kind of article, that it doesn't fit what this journal is normally trying to do. So reject is one option. Major revisions is normally the second option, which means that fairly extensive changes need to be made. And then as the reviewer, you need to explain what those changes, in your opinion, are. So the reviewer is always really has to explain, and almost always they do explain what they want to be changed. It's also possible to recommend just minor revisions, which can be very minor, from say, spelling mistakes and things like that, to other relatively easy things to fix. Or the most extreme or most optimistic option is just accept as it is. But that is unusual. And also in this, it's important to bear in mind that the reviewer also is kind of under a little bit of pressure in this, much less pressure, of course, than the person who's written the piece. But you're kind of expected to come up with something about the article. So in a way, you're kind of looking for something to criticize, a little bit at least, and to offer some kind of suggestions and advice. And I think most people who do this kind of reviewing really do think of it as trying to help in the process of this article manuscript becoming an even better article. I think very few people take pleasure in being mean and rough and just saying no, no, no. So yes, do bear these things in mind, that the reviewer almost always does want some kind of changes. That's just the usual thing, and it's part of the whole peer review process.
So I think I've already mentioned that, yeah, as Pertti said, that they want to help, and they're usually right. Even though it's been hard for me to admit it myself when reviewers have a lot of criticism to my articles, and that happens to me all the time. But when I think about it, I think a really good thing to do is when you get the criticism, read it through, and then wait 2 or 3 weeks. Just put it aside, do something else. When you come back to it, often, at least it happens for me, that I realize, oh, wow, they were really right, that this was really unclear what I had written before. So they do see it through the eyes of a reader, which is exactly who you're trying to you know, you're trying to get your message to a reader, and the reviewer puts themselves in the reader's role and tries to see what the reader might not understand from your text. And then I would say that I hate saying this because it's not fair. It's not fair that the sort of lingua franca of the world, that the kind of international, at least on this side of the hemisphere, is English. And it's not fair. English is my native language. I've always had it easy. But it's not fair for those of you who it's not. And I'm sorry, I hate saying this, but if you are submitting an article in English or a chapter to a book in English, make sure that the English that you send to the editor is good. And the reason for that is, unfortunately, partly it's snobbery, okay? So particularly I've noticed Americans and Brits who have not lived abroad, they tend to look down on English which is not really good. And they also tend to think that there's something wrong with the content, which I think, yes, we have there. So they think it's bad content. They don't understand that you've just used the wrong term or you haven't been able to explain it as clearly as they expect. So it's a snobbery because they haven't been in that position of having to learn a foreign language, okay, and use it every day. But it's also that sometimes what we think, and I know this because I've tried to write occasionally in Finnish, and I can't do it. I cannot write academic Finnish, even though I can speak it. But I can't write it. It takes a whole different skill set that I've never learned. So I know that writing in your non-native language in an academic level is really, really tough. And sometimes we think that, oh, we're writing it really clearly, and then the reader, especially if they're a native speaker, but also if they're from another country and they've learned a slightly different way to write English, they may not understand what you're trying to say. And this is tough. And I know that proofreading costs a lot of money. So I hate saying this to you, but I am telling you kind of the reality, that try to make sure that your English is as good as possible when you send it to the, when it's going to go to review. Because the reviewers, they will be looking at that. And so that I have been a reviewer for articles that were clearly written by, say, a French speaker, and I took into account that, yes, you know, I would say, well, the English needs to be still proofread, but more or less I understood what they were trying to say, and it was good, and I had some major revisions, but I did say that there was many good things about the article. This has happened several times. But it's not everybody lives, and, you know, I'm an English speaker who lives in a foreign country, so I can take that into account, and not all of the reviewers will be, if they're native English speakers, they may not have that experience. So you've got to kind of expect them to be a little snobbish, unfortunately, and it's too bad.
Maybe just to kind of reinforce one thing about that. I mean, everything that Laura said about writing in English and the kind of unfairness of, in some ways, of English being the language that is pretty much used across the globe now for scholarly communication. It's true. It does put people in an unequal position in terms of their native language and so on. But also the importance of the writing itself also applies in other languages, I think. So that certainly in my own field, history, I remember, in fact, one of the people who taught me when I was doing my PhD, he was very keen on stressing that history is a written discipline, that the writing itself is really important. That, of course, you have to do the research, you have to know the literature, you have to have the right kind of source material, and you have to have the analytical points that you develop, but that the writing itself is important, the way you express yourself. And that applies in English, of course, but I think it equally applies in any language that you write, that it's not just a question of collecting the material and then somehow writing it up in a kind of mechanical way, but the written expression can make a really big difference in how your points come across, how persuasive your article is, how easy people find to read it, and so on. So it's worth really thinking about that, I think, and paying attention to the writing.
Okay, and the next one was, if possible, be ready to expand your manuscript in the direction, whatever direction that is, that the reviewers or editors suggest to you. And the reason I say this is because I notice myself that it's very difficult when the most recent article that I just got a review for like a month ago was they said, well, you need more theory. And we suggest these and these and these theories, which I had never thought about. And I'm thinking, oh, do I have the time and the energy to now to get into a new theory and look at the article from that theoretical perspective? But I told myself that I did want to publish in this in this journal so that I would do this work. And you know, it was a really great suggestion that the editor, this was actually the editor's suggestion that he or she gave me, because it turned out that that theory was something I had never come across before and was extremely valuable. In fact, that person had said in a wonderful way what I had always wanted to say. And so now I can use that theory, I can refer to her. And it's, you know, so even if it seems like, you know, whoa, these people are trying to take my article in a different direction, sometimes go with it. Now, sometimes if you look and you do the background homework on whatever theory, whatever direction they want you to go in, and you realize, no, that's really not what I want to say, then that's fine. It's okay to, I think we might have had, somewhere here it says you can walk away. You can walk away from a journal. If you realize that this is not the place for your research, and that's fine. But always do give that extra consideration to the possibility that, hey, maybe this is going to be a really good recommendation for me, even if it feels at the beginning like, you know, they're asking too much from me.
Right. So let's see. We've covered, I think, the first two points of this slide here, more or less. So in a way, it really is a kind of joint effort, ultimately, by the time the article is finished, between yourself and the editor or editors of the journal and then the expert reviewers, all three. And in a way, you as the author, get all the credit, although you should always remember to thank the anonymous reviewers in the first footnote. I think that's sort of common courtesy and general practice. And also relating to that, when you have received this feedback on the article that you submitted, and you've taken a little bit of time, as Laura said, to let out the initial reactions that you may have and think about it more calmly, maybe in a week, maybe in a 2-week period, whatever. Take a bit of time to think about the feedback that you received. They don't expect you to reply the next day. You do have a bit of time. This is a kind of slow process. You don't need to react immediately. It's maybe a good idea to send a quick email and say, thank you for this, I will be in touch soon, but you do have some time to think and so on. And yes, so when you do reply to the editor and the comments that they've sent to you, that the reviewers have probably sent to the editor in the first place, do thank them, do show your appreciation for the effort that they've put in. That's just kind of, again, common courtesy and sort of good manners and good to do, even if you disagree with some of the comments. Do say that you appreciate this and it's valuable feedback and blah, blah, thank you, you know, that kind of thing. And then another thing to point out, maybe I'll just cover the next point and then hand it over to you. You can finish off with that point. You normally will get feedback that has several points in it. Sometimes it's just one thing. Maybe they want you to really pay attention to one particular argument, or maybe they think that you've neglected some key literature. If that's the case, then it's fairly easy to say, I will, you know, you recommend it that I do this, and I will react to that in this particular way. But in any case, it's good to go through the feedback that you get really point by point. Usually there's several points. Often they're already analyzed in or separated into several points by the reviewers and the editor, so you already have them in front of you as a kind of list of things that they want you to consider. And it's a good idea also to react to them point by point. It makes it easier for you, it makes it easier for the editor, it makes it easier for everyone if you're quite clear about your response. So that's a good way of showing from your perspective, your side of things, that you have really read through what they've sent to you in terms of this feedback, and you've thought about it, you've considered those points that they've given to you, and these are the responses that you're going to give to those particular points of criticism and suggestions and so on. Because it's also important to remember that this takes time from everybody, those reviewers also. You almost never get anything for it. It's just kind of free labor that you do for those journals and for the kind of scholarly community. And it can sometimes take quite a lot of time. If you read a manuscript, you think about it carefully, you try to put together constructive feedback, you can't do it in an hour or even 2 hours. It takes quite a lot of time often. So it's important to kind of show that you've read what you received, that you've thought about it, to kind of respond to it, preferably point by point, according to the kinds of points that were raised in the first place. And I'll let you, Laura, finish off this.
Just one more thing about the point by point. So that's, at least for me, and that's what I send when I'm sending the revised manuscript back to the editor. Then I'll have point by point the, okay, yes, I, you know, the reviewer said this, and this is what I've done. So, you know, and here's my revised version. So that would be the point. You don't have to do it immediately, as Pertti said. So just when you have already made the changes in your manuscript, and now you're going to tell the editor what you did and how it was following the what the reviewers asked for. And so then if you choose not to follow a reviewer's recommendation, then explain to the editor why this was not possible. That happens. It happens to me usually if I get a list of, let's say, the reviewer wants 6 things changed. There's always one, maybe 2, that I just can't do it, because one of the things that reviewers do is that you have a very strict word limit. Usually I go over, even on my first version, and then they want you to add things. They get excited about your topic, and they say, well, no, but if you could only look at it from this perspective, and add this, and you might have to say that this was a fascinating suggestion, but you know, the word limit just did not allow me to go into that in the depth that the reviewer asked for. Or you know, this was a really great idea, but it wasn't the focus of my, you know, my research question was different, or my research aim was different. So you just to show that you've listened, but why you can't do it. I've never had the editors after that say, no, you know, you had to follow what the reviewer said. The editors accept it if you have a decent explanation for why you're not going to follow that recommendation. The editor's like, okay. And they'll read through it and make sure that it all makes sense to them, but you can usually get away with that. So, okay.
Maybe just to add to that briefly from my kind of own experience, if you... it also depends. Normally you get at least 2 reviewer reports, depending on the journal. Sometimes it's even 3 or more if it's a very highly ranked journal. But it also makes a difference. If there's one particular point that every reviewer stresses, you probably will not get away by saying, I don't want to do that. If it seems to be something that everybody picks upon, it probably is important and you need to somehow address it. But if you get, say, 2 reviewers reports, often they're never identical. They can be very different, in fact. And they can raise completely, even contradictory points. And in particularly those kinds of cases, the editors typically are quite reasonable and will take your viewpoint into consideration if you can just explain it in a convincing kind of way. Yeah.
I'll just add to that in a minute. So. Yeah. And sometimes the editors have their own viewpoint. So sometimes they will weigh in. They will have their own view, which could even be different than the reviewers, which is what happened to my last article, or they may be in agreement with one of the reviewers more than another. So listen to the editors, most of all, because they are the gatekeepers, the ones who decide whether your article is getting published or not. So, okay, so yeah, I think that was the end of that. Yes. Were there any, so are there any questions or comments about this information that we just covered? Anything that was unclear, or you have a different experience, or you wanted some clarification? Everything was clear? Okay, that's great. If everything was clear, that's good. So we can go forward, and I'm gonna ask you all some questions now. But before I do, just before I forget, so on October 3rd will be my next lecture, and I do want to say to you that additional information on the homework will be in Moodle. Does everybody have access to Moodle? Has everybody used Moodle? Yes, okay, so, and that's okay, that's working for you. I'm probably the last one in this group that learned how to use Moodle, so I'm glad that you all know it. Professor Oyela has put the homework that he's hoping from you before his next lecture, which is, I think, next week. And so please look at that as soon as possible. And then in addition to the homework you'll be doing for him, he wants you to identify, I think it was 3 to 5 journals that you might want to publish in. And you will there's some additional information that you will need that he will want to discuss with you. But in addition, from those journals you have identified, please choose 3 articles. They can be from different journals, they can be from the same journal, but 3 articles from those journals, and take a close look at the structure of the articles. So, do they follow a similar format? How do they begin? How do they present their data, their the source materials? Do they talk about methodology? How do they summarize their main points at the end? So just what are the different things that you notice about the structure? And this same information is in Moodle, so you don't have to write it down right now. You can just find it. I put it today on Moodle. But we will be discussing this in groups. So I'm going to break you into groups for my lecture, and you'll be discussing this amongst yourselves before I actually start my lecture on the 3rd. So just to let you know what I'm looking for from you. Okay? Are there any questions about the homework? Okay.
Are you sure about how yes. to access to the Moodle platform? I think I can do it with my own ID.
You should be, yes, you should be able to. I don't know if students go through the Hakka. No, if that's only for staff. I'm not sure.
I don't know if for the recording if people can hear it. So the question was about accessing the Moodle platform. Yes, I only access it from the sort of staff perspective, but I think through the university main webpage, you go there, it should be one of the, options on the top line, so to speak, and you should be able to, I'm about 99% sure, correct me if I'm wrong about this, with your student ID information, you should be able to get in to it. And then once you do that with your information, you should get a list of the relevant courses in there that you're on. And then if you click this one, you should be able to get to our pages.
But you can always send us an email if you cannot find information. So we're always happy to help, okay? So actually, we both wanted to have a discussion today and open up, first of all, how many of you, raise your hand if you have published in an... Okay, let's start with publishing at all. How many of you have published articles in any language? Raise hands. Ooh, good. Wow, quite a group. Okay, great. How many of you have published in what would be considered an international article in another language or published in another country outside of Finland? Okay, still a pretty good group. Okay, that's great. This is something we want to know, and we also want to know about your experiences. So I'm going to ask that in a minute. I'm going to ask you about your experiences in publishing. But before that, I want to, and I'm going to actually give the microphone to Pertti in a moment so that I can write down I want to hear from you what you're looking for in this course. Because we don't want to give you information that you already have, that's already familiar to you. We want this course to be useful for you. So we understand that you might also have more specific mechanical questions about publishing and, you know, certain things that, and we're happy to give whatever information we can, but I'm going to write them down for us now, and then we know to cover them in our lectures. So I'm going to pass this on to Pertti for a minute while I write down your responses. So please just, you know, raise your hand and tell us what you hope to get out of this course.
Okay, so I'm going to be this microphone boy who kind of takes the microphone to you because of this recording. The only way to get the sound to be heard on the recording is if you have the microphone. So, anyone? Wait, I'll give you the microphone.
I think a good idea regarding the publication of articles could be to revise here some proof articles that we can attend to the arguments and to try to follow the lines of the arguments we can discuss, we can say, well, this could be remote of different disciplines regarding the fact that we are proceeding from different disciplines. We can try with some social public or social science works and so on, and try to revise here in a very brief way. For example, at least one or a couple of sessions to be devoted to that kind of stuff. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Do you want to comment on that?
I think that it's good to hear you say that. This year, we didn't plan the course to be like that, so that these lectures, then, there may not be enough time for that. However, it's good to know that you're interested in, and maybe next year we can plan a course that is where there will be revisions. Right now, that's for the faculty, the course that's open to the faculty is, unfortunately, right now, only lectures, if I understood right, Pertti, yeah. But thank you for letting us know what you're looking for, and I'll think about your suggestion and how we could possibly work that in. Okay.
Just maybe in some ways, for instance, these kinds of exercises that Laura has identified for the lecture on the 3rd of October, it's not exactly what you said in terms of revising the work in progress, but it's closely related to that in terms of thinking about the structure and the arguments and how it's put together, which is then applicable to your own work. And the reason we have, there's a smaller format continuation of this course that does deal with writing a particular piece of scholarship, but because of the kind of differences between different branches of the humanities and the social sciences, there's really very different traditions and expectations and so on. That course this year focuses on, it's focused on the students who study history, ethnology, anthropology, so the department that we're from, just because we really don't feel that we can fruitfully advise people in writing in, say, 10 different scholarly disciplines. But that's a really good point that you brought up and a good suggestion. So, next question. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Yeah, we are always advised to published in international journals, where I come from, but the argument is, how do you define international? What is international? Is it journals outside your country? That's international. How do you define it? Which journals are international journals and which are not international? Thank you.
All right, excellent question. Do you want to take that on?
I think this is something I can bring up in my lecture on the 3rd. We can talk about that, but it's a very good question. Thank you. Okay. Okay, thank you.
So sorry, we have two there. And, okay, one here.
One thing that I was expecting from this is, because I took the course from the Language Center about the same topic or quite similar to the introduction that you just did, Is this going to be more focused on social sciences specifically? Because, well, that's what I was expecting. And also, I have no experience whatsoever in publishing because I just started my PhD. So maybe that's my expectation, really, to know what's the difference between a well-known international journal and, for example, Finnish one, maybe not with this category. I just learned the differences with these categories. So basically that.
Do you want to?
So this course is focusing not just on social sciences, but on humanities. So it's social sciences and humanities. However, with the qualification must be added that actually the lecturers for this course are historians and ethnologists, one ethnologist, two historians, and so we are not experts on things like linguistics, music, literature, art. I mean, there's a whole vast, or the social sciences per se, there's a vast number of areas on which we don't want to give you the wrong advice, so you can always go and ask your own supervisors that, you know, these lecturers said this, but is that true for my field? And they might say no. So keep that in mind, but we're trying to give a kind of a general overview of publishing, especially international publications in the humanities and social sciences. So we are not, and unfortunately, we don't know, we're not linked to the Language Center course in any way. We have no idea what they've taught you, and I apologize for that. That maybe next year we'll try to link up a little bit better with them. Yeah.
But just to add to that a little bit, as you can find out in Korpi or also Moodle now, I think, the structure of the course is such that there's sort of three areas that are going to be covered. And Laura is primarily responsible for sort of telling you how to write scientific articles in English, what to kind of think about there, how to structure them, what sorts of things to keep in mind. And Jari Ojala, our colleague, is going to talk about sort of journal publishing more generally, about how to identify appropriate journals, more or less regardless of what your field is. So it's going to require some sort of independent thinking from you in terms of finding out about information. And he's going to talk about those kinds of things. And then my part primarily is supposed to be about books and edited collections and getting those kinds of things published, contributing to them. So that's the kind of rough outline that we have in mind on a fairly general level.
Speak. And I'll just add something that you had a question about, yeah, how to identify, you know, what are the well-known journals. And I think that Professor Ojala will be talking about that. But one thing is that Google is a really good resource for this. If you just put in your own field, like if I would do ethnology journal ranking, you can find just through Google already sites where they have ranked the top ranking in terms of readership, in terms of how many people are actually reading the articles of that journal, like worldwide. So you can get those kind of journal rankings and citation rankings already just through Google, and I think it's a really useful tool. So that was just something I wanted to add.
Okay, yeah. Sorry to keep you waiting.
Thank you. Well, this is not a question per se, but I was hoping that maybe at some point we might be able to get some tips on publishing multidisciplinary research. It's very personal interest because my research topics are very much on the boundaries of different disciplines. So what to take into consideration when offering an article or making these decisions on where to target the article and sort of what are the limits that I should not cross or you know, any tips on that would be really helpful.
Great, thank you. Do you want to comment on that, Laura? Yeah, I think that's good. It's always a challenge, of course, doing anything multidisciplinary, although we're also being encouraged to do it at the same time. So we'll try to keep that in mind, certainly, yeah.
Thank you. What is the difference between writing an article for a journal and writing a book chapter?
Do you mean what is the difference in terms of your experience in writing it, or what is the or which is better, or all of those questions? Okay, so the question was how the writing process is different for journal articles and book chapters. Yeah, that's a good question. I'll write that down.
Yeah, it's also very good, also quite a complex question, and we'll address those kinds of issues. I don't think we can fully answer it right now. But yes, we'll deal with that. Okay. Yeah.
Hi. Yeah, I would also like to know about the, well, I don't know, surprises that come along in the especially journal writing process. Like, we are always told that we should publish open access and so on, but sometimes your asked to pay money for that, and also were told that it's good to publish in the best journals, but sometimes that can take like 2 years, and perhaps that then that's not so good for you. So about these things that we should expect, but yeah, something about them.
Thank you. Very good, important point. Do you want to comment?
So we will address it, yeah.
Yeah. Maybe just a kind of brief comment on the latter point that you made. They're both very good points, and certainly this question of what the right publication channel for a particular article is a really important one. Yes, on the one hand, it's good to aim for the highest possible channels, but on the other hand, it takes the longest in those, often, not always, but often, and the review process is particularly rigorous, and so it can be, as you said, a couple of years before it's clear fully whether it's taken or not taken. So, and maybe as if it's your first article, for instance, it might be more realistic to aim for a more specialized journal in a sort of maybe a more narrow field rather than the sort of the whole field leading. I don't know, like in my own field, I don't know if American Historical Review, it's kind of difficult to get an article in, but there's other journals that are still perfectly respectable and good and so on. And in fact, you know, the rankings in this sense can be a little bit misleading because obviously the really top-ranked journals, just about every article really is very good. But even in lower-ranked journals, you often get really, really good stuff in there. Maybe sometimes some of the articles are not quite as good, but you do get very good work published in many different kinds of places.
I can add to that. And nowadays, the fact that so much is published on open access or at least online has really changed the dynamics, I think, so that if you have a really good article published in a less well-known journal, but that article, somebody realizes, you know, readers find that article and then they start to cite it. That article will take on a life of its own, which doesn't depend on the journal that it was originally published in, because people are finding it online and they're finding it through each other and the fact that it's in other people's bibliographies. So I would say that this whole thing about the reputation ranking of the journals is changing with the whole online access now. And we don't know exactly what form it's going to take, but it's different than it was 10 years ago, that's for sure.
I have wondered many times before that these referee processes are anonymous, of course. But if you do some Google about the article or some keywords and so on, you probably get the name of the writer. So what are your tips about that sense, that it is good idea to hide your results very long time before sending them, or do the other side, and does this differ in your career of if you get some reputation before, so it might be a good idea that if you are a good writer, so if someone Googles you, that it probably matters at least in the editor level.
Thank you. Good point. I mean, yes, it's anonymous almost always, so that the reviewers don't get to see the name of the person or institutional affiliation or that kind of thing. But of course, sometimes, I mean, I guess it also becomes more obvious if it's someone quite well known already who, you know, or a lot of people know has been working on certain things, and then you can probably identify these people more easily than someone who's maybe writing their first or second article. And also, I'm not really sure that all reviewers will necessarily want to take the trouble of trying to identify the person. I certainly don't, and I don't really want to know who it is. Yeah, just some thoughts.
But I think I agree with Pertti, but I also understand the concerns of junior researchers who are concerned about, you know, what if my ideas are stolen? What if, you know, what if this reviewer takes my ideas? And I can tell you that as a reviewer, there's many times when I see I see an article that's really useful for my research, not in the sense that I could steal it. I wouldn't want to, but in the sense that, wow, I hope they publish because I really want to cite them in my article. But in my field, and so I, as a reviewer, in that case, I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that that person's article gets published because I want to eventually cite them. But at least in my field, where everything is very based on the data, so if someone, I do research in about Tanzania, so if someone from the Congo, Democratic Republic of Congo, writes an article and it's about the Congo, even if I wanted to, I can't steal that because I, you know, haven't done the data. I don't have any way to even make up, you know, that I, you know, did interviews in the Congo. Somebody else could easily find out that I didn't. So I think where you have very clear data, which you have gathered yourself, and you can be fairly sure that no one's going to be able to take your results because they would have to explain how they got the data, and they're going to have a hard time doing that. But of course, where the data is maybe less clear or is shared by, you know, if it's online data, which is open to everybody, then that could become more of a worry. I understand that. So yes, there is no easy answer to this question, but it's a very good question.
Okay. Other comments, wishes, suggestions for us? Yes. Please. Okay.
With this explanation, I would like to know if there's some form of limitation as to where you can publish your article. The journal, yes. Yes. Is there any kind of form of limitation, for example, that once you, okay, this in this way you cannot go there? Can you give us some kind of idea?
Do you mean by field, like you cannot publish in a journal in this field, or?
I'm talking about you talk about the international the standards. So do you have any kind of criteria that okay, this you cannot publish your article over there?
As far as I know, the answer is no. You can try for any journal. And how I know that that's possible is that I had some colleagues from Germany, and I have to admit, maybe people who have spent time in Germany know this system better than I do, but they were getting points, or their department was getting points if they just submitted an article like to Nature or Science, even if they were not even in that field, if they submitted the article to one of these very, very high-ranking, well-known journals, and usually they expect it to be completely rejected, but they got points for submitting. So you can submit, I think, to anything and anywhere. And sometimes the editors, if they really look and they say, wait, this manuscript submission is not suitable for our journal, then they will probably send the author a message saying, I'm sorry, this isn't suitable for our journal, we're not going to send it to review. That has never happened to me, but of course I have tried to select journals that were more or less in my field, but I have, you know, of course by the time I was aware of what the high-ranking journals were, I was already kind of a senior researcher, so I didn't have to go through the same process that all of you do of considering what ranking. But I would say, if you feel confident that you have something to say, something that other people will want to read, then I would say try. Try for the top if you're ready for that. Yeah.
I ask the question because sometimes some of these articles may be very good for local readership, for example, which maybe it might be of policy which you want to carry it across. So that's the reason I asked about this. Yeah.
Yeah, but a lot of that kind of information about just whether a journal is suitable for what you're trying to publish. It's also fairly easily accessible if you look at the sort of web pages of the journal. They usually explain what their kind of area is. So for instance, again, referring to my field, if it's the Economic History Review, maybe they're kind of globally leading journal in economic history, or one of them anyway, which I don't do economic history, so if I tried to submit like a cultural history article to them, they would obviously say this is not for us. And also in other ways, the journals normally explain what they think their mission is and what they publish on and so on. So you can use that as a sort of guideline, although your question was about a slightly different issue, of course.
Actually, I was interested in this course because I thought that you will extend a bit this topic with styles of writing, because I know that many people try to write, you know, in this entertaining style of left review, and this is beautiful. But different journals and different disciplines, they have requirements, special requirements. But it's interesting, but these beautiful written pieces can be published in those journals with a huge amount of requirements, not following those requirements. And I thought maybe you could outline what kind of styles and what kind of styles are more preferable for articles and for chapters, because nowadays I have quite a difficult thing how to construct the text for my chapter having only 5,000 words in it, including references. It's just like it's impossible to even to outline the problem for me. Thanks.
This was a really good question. So for those in the back, if you didn't hear the question, then the question was how will we be going through in this course looking more closely at the kind of style you should use when writing your a book chapter or a journal article, and you know, is this kind of flowery, more beautiful style better, or is another style better? And the question that came up at the very end of your question was if you have only 5,000 words, how do you actually get your message across and explain it? And I think we will be going through this in my lecture. It's going to have to be fast. And what I'm going to give you is, we're going to discuss in groups first, after you've looked at some of the articles that you've found and look at their style, not just structure, I said structure, but style. Also, please look at the style of these journal articles that you are doing for homework for my lecture, and then you'll be discussing those in groups. But what I will be giving my lecture on then is kind of my best guess for a kind of general style which should work in most cases. And I could be wrong for some disciplines, but I've published both in the humanities and in the social sciences and in things that are a little bit more kind of like psychology and things like that. So I know that there are different demands, but I'm kind of going to give you a kind of a model, a simple model that with a little bit of tweaking, a little bit of changing, shouldn't offend anybody too much, you know, that it should probably be something, a basic starting point. So I will be giving that in my lecture, but we will talk about style. Yeah, and it's very, I think that what you brought up about the word limit, it's the word limits are getting smaller. And this really, for academics that are used to, as Pertti said, expressing ourselves through the written word, these word limits are becoming really problematic for us, because most of us, myself included, we don't know how to do that, how to get our message across in so few words. So this is going to be something that I will also be talking about in English, how to do it in English in my lecture. But it's a good, very good question. Thank you. Okay. Any other last things? If not, let's go to the last question. And again, I will have Pertti hold the microphone, but I will just say, I want to hear your experiences of publishing. So you know, regarding anything we've talked about so far or regarding things that we have not brought up yet, if you want to share an experience which I think would be very useful to the rest of also Pertti and I, but the rest of the group, would you know, about what happened to you when you published either internationally or in Finland or in another language or in another country, you know, something that happened that you want to share, that would be, you know, or tell us about, please. The floor is open.
Thanks. I had an experience of submitting an article to international, the best one, ranking journal, international. And after several months of reviewing and revision and again revision, my article was declined. And at the same time, just about a year, the same article under actually a similar title, written by a collective group of research from my country and from abroad country, was published in the same journal. And I'm sure that the journal's very ethical, but you know, reviewers might be not ethical at all. Because the published article was quite similar in structure, but a bit different, you know, materials which were analyzed, less materials even than I presented in my manuscript. And after such a case, I'm not sure how to deal with such issues. Because, of course, I didn't reply anything to this journal and I didn't claim for something, but it was unpleasant.
And the question, how to deal with this? Yeah.
I'm really sorry to hear about that. So that for those of you who maybe didn't hear, so an article was submitted and after several revisions was rejected, and then it was published by different people in the same journal. So pretty much what the author felt to be the same article. And, you know, that can happen. I mean, and it's very terrible. I mean, it's plagiarism, clear and simple, if that is the case. I would say that anytime you have an article that is really close, I mean, it's very seldom that would be by chance, I would say, especially in the same journal, because, you know, people are doing such different research. And so I would say that you have good grounds for a suspicion of very serious plagiarism there. And it's extremely unfortunate. Academia, as we know, is an extremely competitive area. And as it becomes more competitive, we are going to see more of this plagiarism for sure. So the question was, what to do then? And I would say that if you feel, now this depends very much on the country that you're dealing with and the culture that you're dealing with. And I have no idea. If this would happen in Finland, I could tell you that you would want to bring it up and make that public and make a case for that, I think, if you really felt that your work was being plagiarized. I think that in Finland there is increasingly the feeling that plagiarists should be, revealed. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, unmasked, so to speak. But it's a very difficult thing, and a lot of people don't want to make waves, they don't want to create problems because they're afraid that that will affect their career later on, and unfortunately, they are right. I mean, it can create. You know, you especially in a small country like Finland, you can get the reputation of being difficult, hankala in Finnish, and that scares a lot of people away. I hope that the younger generation, I hope that all of you, will perhaps not feel that way and will stand up for your rights, because you have rights, and everyone should be the owner of their own research, and if you've done the work for it, and it's very unfortunate to hear about that kind of case. I don't have a cut and dried answer for you, but I will ask all of us lecturers can think about that for the lectures, and if we, yes, please.
One more question, yeah. Which is,
Thanks. One more question, actually. which follows this one. Nowadays, international journals ask to suggest some reviewers. So, and you should not be acquainted with those your suggested reviewers, and they should be like professionals from your field. How to deal with this? And they ask to suggest not less than three people to review your article.
It's a practical question.
So the question was that since the authors are often asked by the editors to suggest possible reviewers for their article, how do you do this? And I would say that, yes, it shouldn't be a good friend, partly because they can usually tell who you are, you know. However, what I've done is I've suggested people that, I mean, I'm barely acquainted with, people who would not feel, even if they were identified me, people who would not feel that they had to give a good review, but people that maybe I met in a conference once, or people that, you know, just sort of rough acquaintances. Now, for junior scholars, you may not have that wide network, and that becomes difficult. And in that case, I would suggest going to your supervisor and asking for, you know, ideas. But again, people you trust, people that you haven't heard bad things about, you know, in terms of plagiarism, which hopefully that you haven't heard very much, and that would be sad. But yeah, I don't. I would say I've used people who are just kind of people that I might have heard of, but not people that I know well. But I understand that there it may be difficult, and in that case, start to ask colleagues, supervisors, and things like that for ideas, names. Yeah, but that's a difficult one, and the editors are doing that because it's too hard work for them to try to find those people. They are usually the editors of journals there's a huge number of different topics that are being written about in the journal, and they're getting manuscripts on lots of different topics, and the editors cannot be experts on all of these topics. They cannot know who the people are in the field. So that's why they're asking the author to suggest the people. They just don't have the time to find the reviewers.
Yeah, maybe just quickly about the plagiarism issue. That sounds like a really horrible scenario that you were involved in, and that never should happen, and those kinds of situations really should be exposed. But at the same time, I think that we also don't want to kind of exaggerate the prevalence of that kind of behavior, because that is, by common consent, really, I would say, in the scholarly community, consider it so unacceptable that if you get exposed for that, that has a really serious impact. It can even lead to people getting fired from jobs if it can be sort of proved, which can be sometimes difficult. But it happens, but at the same time, I don't think it's all that common, so you shouldn't be, I think, too panicky about that. It does happen. There's dishonest people in this field as there are in other fields, but it is just such a kind of gross violation of all the basic ethics of scholarship that I very rarely come across it, but it undoubtedly does happen.
Thank you. My personal experience. I'm in Ghana, and I wrote an article in Development and Sustainability, a journal in Japan. It is not that highly ranked journal, but it's international. Yes. And now, after a year, I get a message from Taylor and Francis, which is a more highly recognized journal than the one I published in, requesting that I bring or I submit an article because they have cited the one I wrote and they think it was good. So what I'm trying to say here is, yes, sometimes, like my brother was saying, those ones we don't recognize them as highly ranked can be used as a way or to pave the way to the higher ones, like in this instance. And once it is on the net and everybody is reading, people can have access to it. And when they see it's good, they can make references or referrals so that you bring it to the higher ones. Yeah, so that's my experience.
Thank you. That's a very good example.
Yes, thank you very much. That's good.
Other experiences? Well, I can share one quickly as we're waiting for someone else to share their experiences. I'll just share one negative experience that I had that I wanted to say to you. Don't put up with a journal that tells you that your article is rejected and they don't tell you why. They don't give you any review. That happened to me once, and I will never submit to that journal again, even though they're fairly highly ranked. And I don't understand how they can run a journal if they're not going to give any reason for why it's rejected and they're not going to have any review. So that was odd. And I think the reviewers had said it should be rejected, but without any kind of justification, nothing. So don't put up with that, and don't feel bad about that. That is unprofessional journal editorship. That's not something that reflects on you. Okay?
Okay.
One more experience. My experience that it's much more easy to publish an article journal in the thematic issue, because you have a very short lag with the editor of this thematic issue, and you have a group, and your article actually are part of something else, and it's quite easily. It's much more easy to struggle with the system when you are together than when you are alone. That's my experience.
Yeah.
Quick comment on that. The point was is that it's easier to publish in a thematic issue in a journal than in an open issue or open theme issue, and I totally agree. And I think that for that reason, it's really worth it to broadcast to as many colleagues as possible what you are doing and what you're interested in, what you're working on, because it might be that a colleague has an idea for a thematic issue, and if they know that you're working, if they're working in a similar topic, and they know that you are, then they'll invite you to their thematic issue. But if they don't know that you are, then they can't invite you. So try to keep your networks broad and let people know what you're doing. And one of the things that I honestly feel, since we're entering the YouTube age, and we are already there, that make a YouTube video of yourself, of what you're doing and what you are, you know. It may seem very unacademic, but I'll tell you a story. That's how I found a person to be a collaborator on a project with me. We did not receive funding, but we applied for funding, but I would not have found her. She was in Bangladesh. She had made a YouTube video of what she was doing of herself, another professor. But I never, from her university's website, I would not have found her. But I found her through YouTube. So people are looking on all kinds of different, from all kinds of different social media, not just Facebook, but also Facebook, but many, many routes that they're trying to look for collaboration partners on many things like this, projects, thematic issues. Make sure that what you're doing is out there and well known, even if it seems a little, for my generation in academia, it seems strange. But I think it's really the new, probably for the younger ones of you out there, it's a little more familiar, the whole video thing, but it's that this is the wave of the future, I think. Other experiences?
And my advice for young scholars will be to participate as much as possible in international conferences, because on this conference you will meet people who are interested in writing something in common, or in writing a common book with you, or edited volume, and so on. And actually, you can find comrades on this conference, on these events. And yeah, this is actually the same way as establishing networks, but through tête-à-tête communications.
Absolutely, yeah. Participation in international conferences, I totally agree.
Yeah. I totally agree, and I have found people from my own book compilations in which I was an editor and I was looking for writers, I found them through conferences. And these were people writing their doctoral dissertations. So, but I would not have had any way to know about what they were doing unless they had gone to a conference and I had heard them speak or been in a session with them. Yeah, I agree. Other experiences, advice to others based on your own publishing? Things you've published? Okay. Bertie, do you have experiences or advice for us?
Yeah, I have experiences. I'm not sure, really sure how useful they'd be in this. Well, maybe we talked about the earlier about this situation where you get feedback and you don't necessarily have to reply to all of it, and or you do have to in some way reply, but don't necessarily have to do everything that is asked, and how also different reviewers can ask for very different things. Maybe just one brief anecdote, since no one else seems to have one at the moment. I submitted one article a few years ago which dealt with a particular Cold War-related issue in Europe at the border between two countries, one of which was in the so-called Eastern Bloc and the other was in the Western Bloc, where, contrary to the usual narrative of people fleeing from the Eastern Bloc to the Western Bloc and kind of being victimized, a person came from the East to the West and killed people on his way out. And so basically, essentially murdering people to get out of this East Bloc country, so-called, to a West Bloc country. So I wrote an article about this. It was a kind of interesting incident, a particular person, not hugely wide-known case, and I kind of was trying to make broader points about the kind of struggles between the Eastern and Western Bloc and for legitimacy and these kinds of things. I won't get into the details, but I got very contradictory feedback, a very positive review that asked for changes, but was positive, and then one where didn't really have much of anything except kind of very, well, no report as such, but the actual draft manuscript sent back to me with kind of marginal comments saying like, this is rubbish, or this is communist propaganda and that kind of thing. And the editor told me just to ignore that reviewer and to pay attention to the other reviewer. So that's a bit of an extreme example, but you do sometimes get very sort of varying kinds of responses.
Yeah, it's good to be prepared for many different kinds of things. All right, then. Any last questions, comments, experiences? How does this course look to you? Does this look like it might be something useful for you? Okay, that's good to know. We want to make it useful for you. So you can also send feedback by email. If you don't feel like saying it in front of the group, you can also send to any of the lecturers or all of us saying, you know, more suggestions, more things that you had hoped to see in the course and hoped it would be covered. And that's fine. We're always happy to get your feedback. Okay. He did. Yeah, Professor Oyala has a task for you to do before next week, and that's in Moodle. I'm not going to try to remember what that was because I'm probably going to advise you wrongly. So he has very specific instructions in Moodle that you should be able to find easily. So if you don't find them, please give him or send him or one of us a question and saying, I can't open the Moodle, I can't find the homework, and we will let you know what that is. Okay? Okay, if that's it, thank you very much, and we will each of us see you at some point during when we are giving our lectures.